Hey, my name is Akash Thakkar, and this is Sound Business. This is the podcast where we dive into the mindsets and methods of some of the top musicians, sound designers, or audio creators in the world. We're going to interview everyone from plugin makers, performing musicians, video game composers, and everything in between, and learn how they run a successful business and how they're making a killer living in the worlds of music and sound. My hope with this podcast is that you can be exposed to the many myriad different ways there are to make a killer living in the world of music and sound, and help you realize that there's no one right way to get to the top. And with that, let's get into the episode. My guest today is Zach Heide, who's a composer based out of Los Angeles. Zach has worked on a ton of different projects with clients like Disney, DreamWorks, Roblox, and many others, and also runs an online course called the Composing Career Bootcamp, where he teaches composers how to build a full-time career. In this episode, Zach and I talk about the importance of being uncomfortable, the types of opportunities there are in the world of composition, how to start networking as an introvert, his success as a content creator on YouTube, and much more. So without further ado, let's get into the interview with Zach Heide. So I want to start with you posting videos on YouTube since I think it was 2007, you said last time we talked, which is an insanely early timeline. Most people are like, oh, I started in 2015, 2018, something like that. So I want to hear from you what that was like in 2007 when monetization wasn't a thing. That wasn't stuff people were talking about, but you said, let me post educational composer-y musical content to YouTube. I want to hear what you were thinking back then.
Yeah, so I definitely can't take all the credit for 2007 because at that time, I think I had just started playing piano and my dad had the insight to say, hey, like maybe we should get his piano music up somewhere. So YouTube, I think, was just starting. I think YouTube was like 2006, right? I remember the platform was nothing like what it is now. And at the time, my dad was just thinking, oh, let's just get some of his piano videos up there, mostly for friends and family. And what we didn't expect was some of those early videos, because at that time, really anything could do well. It was just the Wild West of the internet. Some of the videos I did, particularly a piano cover I did of the Godfather theme, it got like, I think it was like 100,000 views in a couple weeks, something like that, a couple months. And it was just totally unexpected. So my dad at the time, who was managing the channel, really, I didn't even have an interest in it, was just kind of keeping engaged with it. And then I think after about a year, he was like, do you want to just take this? And I was like, sure. And didn't think anything of it, didn't have any career aspirations related to it. It was just something that existed that periodically, on a non-routine basis, I would just share my piano music. So it started off like that for a long, long time. I didn't have any game plan with it. And then it was really only, I would say, after college, I met a good friend, Frank Tedesco. We started to dig a little deeper into YouTube because he had always really been interested in YouTube as a career option. So he kind of got me interested in sort of the more content creator-y aspects, like what it means to make a good video in the first place, what it means to make a good thumbnail, thinking about your titles. And we started to do that on our own channel, but it informed how I approached my channel. And then about 2017, I decided to pivot on my channel because we were already doing piano covers on his. So I said, why don't I just start doing more composing stuff, more educational stuff, just share kind of what I'm doing behind the scenes. And slowly that developed into what it is now, which is primarily an educational channel for composers. But it certainly did not start off that way.
So nowadays that you are kind of in the flow of making all this educational material, are there things that you're seeing as commonalities among like up and coming composers of skills that may be lacking or things that you'd love to teach them, anything like that?
That's interesting. One thing, I don't know if it directly answers your question, but one thing I've noticed from composers who are trying to do it for a living now is there's a couple challenges that they have. One of them is that there are resources everywhere, which is actually both an amazing thing and also a really challenging thing because people have lots of resources, but there's so many shiny objects on YouTube now where there's all this free stuff that people often don't really know where to start, don't really know what's valuable, and on top of that, really get caught into this trap of watching more than doing. I feel slightly responsible for it. But when I do like a composing in real time video and I show people what it looks like to do it for an hour, I think composers who are into that really enjoy watching that full process. But you're only getting so much when you're watching it. You might learn some pointers, tips, and tricks, but ultimately you learn when you go out and do the thing itself. And most composers I know, back when I was doing coaching, they say, I really want to compose, I really want to do this for a living, or I want to get better. So how often are you composing? I'm like, well, I haven't really started yet. Or it would be like, I don't know, I've been stuck on this piece for a year. And it's like that exercise of just kind of doing, I think is hard for people, especially now because there's so much stuff out there and there's a lot of comparison that we tend to make towards all these other people that are making stuff.
Mm. So when you are kind of talking to composers or even just watching, do you tend to kind of break things down into say like, okay, you just need to focus on XYZ things because they need to start small? Or are you trying to clear away the intimidation where they see someone on YouTube and be like, oh my God, that's amazing, I could never do that, let me quit? How are you kind of helping them make that first step?
Yeah, I mean, I think that doing anything is better than waiting until there's a perfect game plan in place. In my bootcamp, I actually talk about this, but I've observed there's kind of two types of composers in my experience. And there's the middle ground, I suppose. But the two kind of like classic images I see, there's, I call him Alex the artist. So Alex is the composer who is waiting for it to be perfect before they release it. They're meticulous. They spend a lot of time doing their research, but they often get very perfectionistic about their work and therefore don't release a lot and kind of feel stuck in their own head. Then there's, I call him Harry the hustler. and Harry is the complete opposite. Harry is like guns blazing, tries everything in every direction, just shoots in every direction. And while they're getting a lot done, they might not have like clarity of focus as to why they're doing the things they're doing. I kind of think that I used to lean more towards Harry. I've never been like a huge perfectionist about stuff. I've always just been like very impulsive. And when ideas catch my interest, I just run towards it. So I've had to actually rein myself back a little bit and be more thoughtful about my process and focus on quality sometimes over quantity. But many of the artists that I would teach, people who were interested in education, like as students, tended to be more like Alex. And so like the first thing that they have to do is just start trying things and being willing to fail, be willing to experiment, introduce more fun and curiosity into their process of making music, as opposed to like trying to make it perfect right out the gate. Because that's how we start as kids when we start to write music. And I started young. But when you start later, you have all that self-doubt and all those things that kind of stop you from just loosening your inhibitions and just trying things. So I think that's the starting point. And then I think from that point, the other like super actionable things people can do is just start small and try and solve like one compositional problem a week. So you have to become self-aware about like where your weaknesses are. Take the judgment away from that. So stop telling yourself like, oh, you know, I'm a piece of crap, I can't write this music, why can't I do like this? I'll never be like this. That's not constructive. You have to just drop that and just look at it like a problem that can be solved. Like, oh, I'm really struggling with wind writing. What am I struggling with about wind writing? Oh, well, I don't really know how to use them in my orchestral music. Let me listen to some examples of orchestral music that do use it well. Not compare myself to it, just be objective about it. Try and take one learning outcome out of that. So maybe it's like, oh, wow, winds really seem to do all these runs all the time. They really seem to like add a lot of frosting to the cake or whatever. And then let me implement that in the very next piece that I write, which is going to be tomorrow. See if that works, test the hypothesis. And if it works, then you put it in your back pocket as a new tool. And you just continue to build your tools that way, bit by bit, instead of seeing this insurmountable, you know, I can never write orchestral music, because it starts with individual steps like that.
Mm. There's this concept in chess where you drill, where you basically set up the board in such a way where you're just, okay, I'm going to work on these two moves. The black is in this position, I'm in this position, we'll just do these three moves and see if we can get to checkmate. That's basically what you're telling people to do here, is like, here's a small, tiny piece. What can you do? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's Marco Pierre White, Gordon Ramsay's instructor. He says perfectionism is lots of little things done well. That's essentially what it is. And it's just that we tend to focus on the output. Also, I think loving the process is a huge part of that too, because you have to fall in love with that process of being curious and making those little discoveries. And I think I've always naturally enjoyed solving problems. That's just how my brain works. That's why I also like chess, actually. I like chess. I like Super Smash Brothers because it's like a thing where I feel like if I'm struggling in that game, there's something I could be doing better. And there's like a problem to solve within there. Like, I enjoy those kinds of things. I find that stimulating as opposed to like discouraging. And I, for the record, like used to deal with that like everybody else did. There are albums and composers that I could only listen to for like 5 minutes before I'd want to shut it off because I would feel so bad about how much of a gap there was between me and them. But over time, I've kind of realized like that attitude that you have about, you know, I don't even want to look at this. That's like all ego. And the more you can just strip that back and just look at it like, all right, well, first of all, they got 20 years on me. And second of all, like, what's just one little thing I can get from this? If somebody learns one new thing every week, you've got 52 new things at the end of the year. And that really compounds. And over 5 years, you'll be like way better than you were before then. So it's just taking those little lessons and moving from there.
So if someone is in this state where they are, you know, making these little, like using these little lessons, they're practicing regularly, there comes a point where they're like, okay, I want to get paid. I want to find clients. I want to make this real, you know? Where is that first step? Because like you said, just like with actual composition stuff on YouTube, there's endless options. Same for a career in composition. You can orchestrate, you can write for TV, you can do all these little things. How do you tell people to kind of start? And how did you start in that field as well?
Yeah. So that's like the whole second step. It's funny because people get to the point where they finally are like, okay, yeah, now I feel like I am writing good music. And then it's like, well, that's awesome. Now you have to learn this. And I had the same experience because I went to classical composition college, kind of got the crap beaten out of me artistically and was like, wow, I really don't know what I'm doing. And built up all that confidence to the point where I'm like, hey, I'm writing some good music. Where's the work? And quickly realized that like that's a whole separate skill. So that was a really painful process for me, honestly. I had no idea how to do it. I was trying to be proactive in different ways, but it was just really tough not having that guidance. And it was frustrating. You know, I loved my school and I appreciated the education I got, but it was frustrating not having gotten really any of that guidance as to like, hey, when you graduate, no one's going to be listening to your music anymore. No one's going to be checking up on you. So here's what you need to do next. So basically, I floundered for a long time. I taught piano for years in my hometown. I played at some local churches. And that was really the extent of the paid work that I was getting for quite a few years. Moved to Tennessee with my friend Frank and my now wife. And just because it was affordable, we wanted to go somewhere other than our hometowns. We started our YouTube channel, which kind of picked up some stuff, taught us some social media skills and whatnot, but honestly still was not really getting a lot of composition work. It was a really slow process that the boring answer is lots of time and lots of networking and lots of trial and error. But eventually it did pick up. I started to meet the right kinds of people. I'm putting air quotes out. The right kinds of people that were able to actually help me. I had to get out of my comfort zone because I really did not like meeting people or networking. I found it really uncomfortable. I had to find ways to make that comfortable for me and enjoyable. And eventually moved to Pasadena in California right before the pandemic hit, which was awful because all the work that I'd built up kind of fell apart all over again. And basically fast forward, thankfully, I've built up enough relationships with people over time and my social media presence online has helped where I've been able to build trust with people. Because ultimately, that's the shortest answer is like, if you want to do this for a living, you have to build trust with people. And trust is not just about the quality of your work. It's about who you are, getting yourself out there so people could imagine what it would be like to work with you. And those are actually skills that can be learned. They take time, especially if you're doing that on your own. But like, yeah, I made the bootcamp because that's what I'm trying to teach people is mostly those skills. So they don't have to spend a decade like it took me to be able to do this and start finding some work opportunities.
So you mentioned that, you know, going out there and meeting people was tough at first, and it was for me too, 100%. And I think most people listening to this are introverted as well. So I'm curious what you tell them when they're like, oh God, I don't want to go to a networking event, or I'm, you know, maybe they're even scared. Like, how do you kind of hype them up?
There's two aspects, I think, to it. I think the first aspect is just the fact that it's framed like networking already sets people up for discomfort. And it's reasonable discomfort, because you're uncomfortable because you, in some cases, are really just hoping that you meet someone who can get you some paid work. And so coming in with that approach is like very uncomfortable for people, because they're going, well, God, like, yeah, I feel like a salesman. I feel like I'm just meeting this person being disingenuous just so I can get something from them. And so the first thing they have to do is, it's a very Zen attitude where it's like, I get that you want paid work. I get that you want to do this in the industry, but you need to like let that go a little bit and just be present and just be with the person you're talking to and do these things because you have a genuine interest in connecting with other people in your industry and learning from people. It can be a really fun process if you make it that way, and you don't have to ask for anything. That stuff will happen naturally over time. You just have to be present and just be you. The second thing, I think, is that not all networking mediums or methods are for every individual person. I went to a convention in LA, I think shortly after I got here. And it wasn't really for me, honestly. We did a meeting, like a networking mixer thing. So there were like 50 other artistic people in a room, and they would hit a bell, just like speed dating. So it's like every 5 minutes you go to a circle of like four people, and they're like, I do this, blah, 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 I do this. And yeah, you kind of hone your elevator pitch, and then you all pass your business cards, and then the bell rings and you reset. And we did that for an hour. And I remember when I came out of that, I looked at my business cards and I realized I didn't remember any of them, any of the people. It just went by like a blur. I never really had an opportunity to connect with people. And I'm much more partial to one-on-one meetings as opposed to big groups. So for me, like, I do stuff like this, actually, where it's like, hey, why don't we just schedule a Zoom call? Like, I just really like what you do. I want to know more about what you do. Like, do you have time? And I'll do small asks. Do you have time for like a 15-minute phone or Zoom chat, you know, anytime in the next week? And those are the relationships that if you keep fostering those things and you enable yourself to do it in a way where you feel like you're being you, those people, if they gel with you and who you are, they come back with work opportunities, even if you don't ask for them.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I think people would be surprised how often people say, yeah, sure, to little requests like that, even if you don't know that person.
It's so true. I read a book called All You Have to Do Is Ask. There was like that one survey in there. I think they pulled people who were about to ask people in New York for their cell phone, if they could borrow a cell phone. And they pulled, say, you know, how many people do you think are going to say yes to your request? How many times before they say yes? And I think they were off by like some huge multiplier. It was like they thought it would take like 12 times and it took like an average of two. It was like people are much more willing to help you than you realize. It's about that vulnerability of asking for help that makes people uncomfortable, I think.
Yeah.
Saying like, I don't have work opportunities. I'm struggling. Can you help me? That's when most opportunities came my way, is when I was just vulnerable with people.
Yeah. Just straight up asking and being clear, and but not desperate, obviously, just telling it like it is.
Yeah. You'd be honest. Exactly. What people don't like is when you pretend like you're interested in reconnecting with them and then you not so subtly pivot into asking for something. It's like, if you really are reaching out to this person just because you want to ask for their help, just come right out the gate and ask for the help. I know it's been a while. There's something called an accusational audit where like you can basically just address anything that you think is going to rub them the wrong way. So it's like, hey, I know we haven't spoken in 2 years. I'm really sorry about that. I would love to connect with you. The reason I'm reaching out is because I'm really struggling. I'm trying to do this for a living. I haven't been able to find any connections. Is there any chance you know 2 to 3 people that could help me? If people do that with people they know, for starters, like, that is what it takes. Again, just like composition, those small baby steps stack up into suddenly having people in the industry that know you, that you know, and having those relationships that lead to work.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of some of those like baby steps and how they paid off for you? Maybe you talked to someone and 6 years later they hired you or something like that.
I have like a couple, yeah. So I was not always good at asking for help. I'm proud and love my entrepreneurialism, and I love like building my business of composing and education. And so I was not always like open to that, to saying to someone, I don't know what to do. And I kind of hit a breaking point when I was in Tennessee where I really, there's been a couple times in my career where I would think I've tried everything. Like I've really tried everything. I'm completely out of options. And I hit one of those points when I was in Tennessee where I was like, I just don't know what to do. And so out of back pocket desperate options, I was like, I don't know. Is there anybody I know from high school maybe I could reach out to? Felt totally awkward about it. There was one guy, TJ, who was a couple grades above me. I didn't know him that well, but I knew that he was an actor. And so I thought, I don't know, here's a Hail Mary play. Let me just reach out and just send him a Facebook message that said, hey, I know we haven't talked, exactly what I said. I know we haven't talked in a while. I hope you're doing well. I have a huge favor to ask you. Like, can you think of anybody? Weirdly enough, TJ responded and connected me with a guy named Cole, who is part of a D&D group on Twitch called Merry Mercenaries. And through Cole, number one, working with Cole, he really liked my work. And I wound up working with him for, I think, a year and a half straight. Every week, I would write a queue every week. And it was paid work. And then from him, I started to branch out, reach out to people in that network. I wound up having like a good 3-year career where my primary income source as a composer was writing D&D music for Twitch streamers, which is not at all what I expected to do, but I was open to it and it was really fun. And it all just stemmed from kind of a, like I said, a Hail Mary play asking an old high school friend. And it seems like luck. I think when people tell these stories, it seems like luck, but it really, sure, so there was some luck involved, but the reality is I reached out to like 50 plus people before that and got nothing. So it's about not waiting for that luck to occur. It's about leaving as much space as possible for it to happen. But that involves a lot of proactivity and a lot of pushing through that discomfort and frustration that you deal with along the way.
You hit something really important where you said you couldn't have possibly predicted or even known that you'd be writing music for D&D's Twitch streamers, right? And I'm sure in college that wasn't the thing. Like, this is why I'm going to school. But there's an odd belief with a lot of composers in any field where they tend to think, I'm either John Williams or I'm nothing. Like, that's the only opportunity is writing for Star Wars. Otherwise, there are no other jobs. Can you maybe dispel that myth a little bit?
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody wants you to be John Williams in the industry. I don't think clients want that. I think that what's happening usually is you're saying, I have so much love for this composer and this person who inspired me that doing anything that looks like this person or writing music that sounds anything like this person would be like fulfilling your childhood dreams. But I think in reality, like, you know, you definitely can't predict where your career is going to go. And I try to use the metric for the success of my career not being like an arbitrary thing that I pointed at when I was young, because for me, it was, for the record, John Williams too. I'm like everybody else. I was like, I want to write like John Williams. But the metric for me is how much I enjoy the actual projects I'm working on. And I think, just like anything, you know, you can't pre-predict like what you're going to enjoy. You have to try it at least once and see. And that's true of a lot of things in this industry. So for me, it was like, whoa, there's an opportunity to get paid to write music here. That was like the baseline win in my book. Was my goal, and I said it forever, was I want to make a living making music. And that is broad enough where there's a lot of wins that can happen within there. If I had started off and said, my goal is to, well, I mean, I did say this actually, to be fair. I said, my goal is to write music for Pixar, but that's a stretch goal. I think there's the dream goal, and then there's like the practical goal. And the practical goal has to be something that can actually be like accomplished in a reasonable amount of time where you don't lose all hope. So it's good to stretch yourself and aspire to things, but at the same time, you want to have like a metric that's grounded and based in your actual experience. So for me, writing music for D&D, no, it was not something I expected to do, but it fit what I was trying to accomplish, which was make money making music. And then I actually wound up really enjoying it. And the same has been true of a lot of other things in my career. I did not expect YouTube to be a part of my career at all. I was just doing it because I enjoyed it. And then eventually it wound up becoming, you know, a partial income source for me. So it's about like really being self-aware and trying those things, being open to it, and then not being afraid to pivot if there's opportunity that exists somewhere, even if it's not what was in your original game plan.
And I want to hear you talk about having jeopardy in your career as a composer, because you wrote this lovely little article on that and the importance of it. So can you explain that concept and why that's important?
Yeah. Jeopardy is tough for me. I think there are artists that are more risk takers than I am. I will take risk, but I hate it. Like, any opportunity I have to quantify that risk or make it feel more safe for me is an opportunity I jump at. One of the hardest things I ever did so far in my career actually was making the boot camp, to be honest, because I was really passionate about it. On a practical level, I also thought it could be like a really good passive income source for me, but I also believe that it could really help a lot of composers that were in the same situation that I was in. But in order to kind of validate the idea, I knew I was going to have to dedicate a lot of time, turn down a lot of work opportunities, and just, I mean, I track my hours and I sunk 300 hours into it from start to finish. It was a lot. I mean, there was certainly more safe, directly paid opportunities that I could have taken during that time that I willingly turned down to pursue this thing. And it was really scary, like, especially because I have a move coming up. I'm supporting my wife right now. So like, there was financial risk involved with that, time risk, which scares me even more. But I knew I had to do it. There's that awful, exciting feeling where you're like, oh crap, what am I about to do right now? But you can't stop yourself because I know if I didn't do it, I would regret not doing it. I've never tried something and regretted trying it, but I know that I would regret it if I hadn't tried it. So that's how I approach it. I use fear of regret, I think, is something that drives me, honestly, a lot. Of just like, if you don't do this, you're going to wish you had. And yeah, and I mean, you have to push yourself because you do your best work when you're challenged. And you have these tiers of comfort that happen in your career. I mean, a lot of composers fall into the trap of, they just get comfortable with like being by themselves and writing music. And it's like, that comfort is what is holding you back from getting the career opportunities that you're looking for. You have to break that comfort and start networking with people. And then when you do that, you have to break that comfort and start pitching your services. You know, you have to break that comfort and start getting comfortable with raising your rates. Break that comfort and get comfortable with turning down work. There's all these aspects of challenges and risks that come in each phase of the career. And if you don't approach those head on, I think you stagnate and you feel too comfortable, and people don't do good work when they're too comfortable. So I don't like it, but I do it.
That's great. I love it. Were you feeling that when you had that urge to get out of your hometown and move away somewhere? Was that the same kind of thinking? Or was it just, maybe you even just were like, no, I'm done. I just got to get out of here.
I was a little bit more open-minded to it, I would say. Like, I wasn't terrified of leaving. I knew I had to. Because in my hometown, I come from a nice, well-off suburb in Connecticut, and I get paid pretty well for piano lessons. I get paid pretty well for church gigs. If I wanted to, I could have stayed there and done that for the rest of my career and done really well, arguably a lot better than I had for a decade afterwards. So it was not a move that was motivated by making more money at all. It was a move that was motivated by, I don't feel like this is the best version of myself. I feel like I'm capable of more. And if I stay here, I'm going to feel too comfortable and I'm not going to push myself. I was more open to it, but there have been plenty of times when I have been much more terrified of that change.
And you've been in the kind of LA-ish area for a little bit now, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on location. You know, LA is a place where things happen, you know, and people listen to this from all over the world, so they might not be close to LA or even in the US, and they're thinking, oh, I can't write music for anyone because I don't live in LA, I don't live in New York, I don't live in Seattle. So what are your thoughts on location for a compositional career?
I'm not a big believer that you have to live in LA to do this for a living. The reason I'm here and the reason I moved here in the first place was not to find work. I was actually getting some work at the very tail end of being in Tennessee, composing and doing copyist work and orchestration and other things. I moved here because of challenge. I felt that I could be challenged by being around other creative people, and I could push myself out of my comfort zone by doing more networking and things like that. It was more of a personal desire to feel like I'm part of the industry, as opposed to a necessity of like, if I don't move here, I'll never find work. And even today, I mean, my clients would probably say the same thing. I meet with most of my clients that are LA based, maybe once a year for like an hour of pizza or something. Like, I'm still not terribly social out here. Most of the work that I get, most of the work I do is still remote, even if it's from people here. I don't go to studios. I don't commute. I work in my home studio. And I love that. And I really enjoy that. I love that flexibility that if I decided to go somewhere else, if I decided to move to a different country or a different state, that my career would not fall apart. That was something I built into my mindset of how I'm going to approach my career from the beginning, is I wanted that freedom. So yeah, no, I don't think people need to. I would say, truthfully, the only time that you'd really probably need to be in LA is if you're doing work that is tightly linked to a production. So if you are dead set on, I have to do AAA film work or something like that, and those directors have to come to the studio and sit on my couch and listen to my music. Or if you just really want that and you just want that, you know, you like that person-to-person thing, then yeah, LA is of course a great option, but it's also really expensive. And so I don't think that anyone should feel like they need to move here to find work. I think there are plenty of ways to network with people remotely. And post-pandemic, everyone in the industry has become 5 times more open to that than they used to be.
Definitely. Now, I'm curious how you go about self-promotion, because there's, you know, meeting friends and networking and stuff, but people still need to know that Zach Heide can be hired, right? That's a whole other thing. So how do you kind of think about that? How do you share in a business sense, you know?
Yeah. So the way I think about it is there's two aspects to, like, people knowing what you do. There's the networking aspect. And that's honestly, if I had to prioritize all the different, like, business things that composers can do, networking is number one, because the face-to-face one-to-one interactions will always yield the most results for your time. The most challenging part with networking is, even if we really hit it off with someone, they may not necessarily have anything that they're working on that they could involve us with or in their pipeline. And so the next challenge is, how do we stay top of mind for the people that are in our network so that when work opportunities come their way, we're the first person they think of? And the way that I solve that is by posting online. I'm half content creator, half composer, I suppose. Not by design, it just happened that way. But I don't think people have to be straight up content creators. I don't think you need to be uploading to TikTok and Twitter and YouTube and Instagram. And I mean, it's a lot of work. So I think the easiest thing you can do is just, like, once a week, whatever social media platform you actually like and use, if you use any, post something. It could just be something simple. It could be something you're working on, piece of music. It could be a little behind the scenes. I personally am a big fan of getting your face on camera and doing a video, because that's where people can really get to know you. But it doesn't have to be a big polished thing with a crazy title and thumbnail. It's just got to be just getting something up to date and treating that as almost more important than your portfolio or reel, because that's where people are seeing what you're up to. I can't tell you how many times I've had it where it's like, you know, I would think, why did this person reach out to me now? And then sometimes I'll ask them, what made you think of me? And it'll almost always be, oh, well, I saw you posted this thing on YouTube and I was like, oh, you'd be great for this. So that's where it starts, is like networking number one. And then I think just general upkeep online is number two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an interesting thing about that where with this podcast, I've even gotten projects where someone reached out to me and said, hey, we'd love for you to work on this thing. I'm like, oh, how did you find me? We've never met before, don't really know each other. And they're like, oh, I saw you interviewed one of my friends. They didn't listen to the episode. They just saw that I happened to interview someone they knew. So you never know where these little things can go when you're posting online, because the threads can go super far.
Exactly. You have this amazing tool, which is the internet, which has this seemingly infinite reach. Not using that, especially if you're not living in LA, is a huge detriment to you. Like, totally candid, I think if you're not living in LA or somewhere with where you have in-person people, you have to be posting online. You cannot expect people to find you. The more time it takes for someone to search you, find the right link, listen to your music, decide if they like your music, find your contact page, write out an email, go through a quote, the more buying friction there is, like, all the way down that pipeline, the less likely they're going to do it. And we just have to assume that everybody in our pipeline or interests, just assume that they're all busy people and make it as easy as possible for them to see what you're up to and to get in touch with you. So I think the internet is arguably the easiest way to do that these days. And it's not a huge amount of maintenance. I think people, like I said, get caught up in thinking, I don't want to be a content creator. I didn't want to be a content creator either, actually. But you don't have to be. I do the content for my educative platforms and stuff. And sometimes content leads into client work. But you could just post a little bit. It's just a little bit of upkeep, the same way you would update a reel or resume or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when people kind of get into that space where they're thinking, oh God, okay, now I need to post a TikTok a day or something. You're never going to do that unless you're really, really dedicated to social media.
Yeah. I hate shorts, like shorts and reels and TikToks. I just don't. They make me feel like I'm eating junk food. Like, I love hate them. You know what I mean? Like,
I know what you mean.
I watch them for like an hour and my wife, Natalie, will be like, yo, what were you watching? I'm like, I don't remember. I don't remember what I was watching. Actually, it just went by like a blur. So like, it's not my preferred way to consume content or create it. So just like with networking, you're finding a way that feels natural to you. You find that most natural entry point into sharing your work online. If you hate Instagram, then don't use Instagram. Like, you don't want the successful version of what that is anyway. So do what you actually like. But the truth is, you do have to do more than just make music to do it for a living. You have to fall in love with those processes of those things, of networking and marketing, in order to really enjoy this job.
Yeah, definitely. Because it's not like Mozart's Day where you could just compose and people make cool and that's the end of it.
Yeah, and I think it can be fun too. I mean, you know, even on that point too, those people had commissions and things too. I mean, like Haydn was writing a crap ton of music for royalty. Like, who knows if he wanted to do that or not? I mean, maybe that was just the easiest gig he could find. And I'm sure he had to play politics. I'm sure he had to network. I'm sure he had to market himself. Like, we forget that these composers, to get paid to do music or any kind of art, someone has to deem you valuable enough to them to be worth paying. And that does not inherently just come from having good music, because there's so many composers out there with good music. And I think trying to write the best music ever is, number one, impossible, and number two, like, way too stressful. It's like, you just need to write music that's good enough and then be connected with people who enjoy you and what you do and working with you enough to choose you instead of some other composer.
So you're at the state now where you're making a full-time living off of composing, you're running courses, you're from the outside absolutely living the dream. There's nothing to change, nothing to do, everything's great. But I'm curious what you are learning right now. It could be audio related or not, but what your kind of next mountain that you're climbing is.
Oh man. Well, you know, like, the problems just change, right? Like, it used to be a problem of getting paid, and then the problems shift into different ways. I mean, honestly, the thing I've been spending a lot of time on is trying to learn marketing, because it's very meta to talk about this, like, while we're talking about my boot camp. But the truth is, like, I spent so much time learning the skills and then learning how to teach the skills. I didn't really spend a lot of time learning how to present those things as things that could be valuable to other people. So marketing has been a huge knowledge gap for me. And I've been spending a lot of time trying to learn that, both for the bootcamp, but it's also been really useful for my client work as well. And things that I can teach to people in the bootcamp or other composers. So marketing's been a big one. And then honestly, my 2024 goal has mostly been to take some of the time that I've bought back for myself and just start to invest in the non-career stuff for me. I've been trying to justify just buying things for fun now. So like, I bought a puzzle box subscription because I love puzzles. I'll let you know how it is. It looks That's interesting. Amazing. But just trying to do more stuff for me, because I love the career and I could spend every waking hour on the career, but I also need to spend time for me. So I'm trying to lean into that more. That's where I'm honestly learning the most, I think.
Awesome. So there's a question I ask everyone who comes on here, which is, when you first started out, it could be when you were learning piano as a wee child, or it can be when you started to compose, whatever starting point you want to pick. What was your definition of success, and how has that changed over time? And what is that definition now?
Wow. Ooh, that's such a good question. I think, like everybody else, like we talked about with John Williams, what I pictured myself doing was, in a large part, like what I saw these composers doing in interviews. I don't know if you watched interviews a lot when you were...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was obsessed with interviews. They just made the whole thing look so romantic and just this endless thing of fun. It's kind of like when you're watching a detective movie and they show the montage and you go, that looks so badass. But then you really think about it, you're like, well, they're just reading documents. Like, the reality is, like, I'm sure any forensic expert would say, like, yeah, it's not like that, you know? But I was just obsessed with that vision, that romantic dream of what it looked like to be a composer. And there are times when that you feel like that, for sure. There are definitely times. I've had my music recently recorded by a live orchestra a couple times in the last few months. And every time that happens, I feel like that. I feel like a kid, like, whoa, I'm, like, doing what I dreamed of doing. But then there's also a lot of times where it doesn't feel like that, where it feels a lot more like a desk job. So I think my definition of success has changed much more into making sure that as many things as I'm doing in the day feel enjoyable as possible. Whether that means starting to say no to things that aren't enjoyable, whether it means kind of changing the proportion of the things that I'm doing. You know, like, that's been a big one for me. I recognize that me spending 40 hours a week doing nothing but writing music in front of a computer is not really that fun for me personally. It used to be, but, you know, of course, it's like, you know, having ice cream every day. Ice cream's great, but, you know, if you overdo it. So finding a balance where I can really put 100% of my energy in and maintaining and protecting that balance is now my definition of success. And I'm pretty happy, actually, with... When people ask me how I am these days, I actually say I feel balanced. I feel very balanced with what I've got. But it took a while to get to that point, be okay with whatever that balance looked like.
Awesome. What a great note to wrap up on. So last question, where can people find you? Where can people find out about the Composer's Bootcamp? Plug anything you want.
Okay, sweet. All right. So Composing Career Bootcamp, if you're listening to this in February or March, there's still time to enroll in Cohort 2. It's a cohort-based course, so we're doing live streams once a week, but there's also 6 modules of course material. That's like over 120 videos, many, many, many hours. And last cohort, we had 60 students, and they had some really amazing wins. Some of these people had never networked or done anything like that before, and now they're not only having people in their industry, but they've got paid work, which is amazing. So if you're interested in that, I would love to see you there. If you're not interested, no problem. I've got plenty of free stuff on my YouTube. I've got a newsletter, which is also free. And if you want to listen to my music, it's zachheidi.com. That was pretty good. That was pretty good for marketing. I'm learning.
That's a perfect pitch. Thanks so much for taking the time, Zach. This is amazing and very inspirational.
Dude, my pleasure, man. This is so fun.
That's the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, as always. And considering I work in the world of video game music and sound, and so many people are always asking me how they break into that field, I have a newsletter set up for you. So if you want to learn how to make music and sound effects for video games and actually be paid to do it, just go to bit.ly/soundbizpod. Sound, B-I-Z, pod. And that newsletter will set you up with 2 free courses and a bunch of free ebooks and even sound effects. They'll get you set up and teach you how to work in the world of video game music and sound. Thanks so much, and I'll see you next time. And if you're looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to, this podcast is actually a part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. So if you want to check those out, hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org.